This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. A few weeks ago, India's deputy prime minister said there has been a sea change in the decades-old conflict over the disputed state of Kashmir. India's rivalry with Pakistan has led to three wars, an Islamic insurgency, and a nuclear arms race. We now know that competition contributed to nuclear dangers around the world. A Pakistani scientist recently admitted to selling secrets to Libya, Iran, and North Korea. But now, India and Pakistan are preparing for peace talks starting on Monday. And we will start this hour by talking about those talks. You can join in the conversation. Later, we'll take a kind of audio tour of the wild and mountainous region at the center of this dispute. So call us if you have ever been to Kashmir. Tell us what you've seen. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us to begin the program from Lahore, Pakistan, is political analyst Hassan Askari Rizvi. Welcome to the program. Hi, can you hear me, Mr. Rizvi?
Yes, thank you.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you.
So more than 50 years of conflict here, approaching 60 really, between India and Pakistan. From where you sit in Lahore, from the people you speak with on the streets every day, is there a feeling in Pakistan that things could change?
Well, there is a sea of change in the thinking here, and the change is that the people think that the new and the peaceful method should be tried, because the policies of confrontation and conflict going over several decades have not produced results, so now go for peaceful methods.
The fears of nuclear war over the last couple of years have changed people's minds, do you think?
I think that has contributed to a great extent. I think two factors can be mentioned here. First, they have realized over time that wars and confrontation has not produced result. Second, with the induction of nuclear weapons, war is no longer an option, because war means devastation and destruction of both countries. So these two factors have contributed a lot to the change that is felt not only in Pakistan, but also in India, because number of people are now traveling from India to Pakistan and Pakistan to India, and those people who come back from India give us the information that even on the other side, there is a genuine feeling and desire to try the new method.
And you raise an interesting point, because you're in Lahore, which is very close to the border with India, and yet that is a border that for much of the two countries' history has been effectively closed, right? It hasn't always been that people are going back and forth between India and Pakistan.
You are right. I'm sitting here almost 30 miles away from the India-Pakistan border, and hardly anything was moving on this border since December 2001, and now the border is open, the train service is there, then there is a regular coach service between India and Pakistan, and the air services have also been resumed between the two countries from Lahore to Delhi. These services are now available.
Now, Mr. Rizvi, a little later on in the program, we're going to have a very full description of the geography of Kashmir, what it's like to travel there. But for now, can you just describe very briefly for me the province that's been at the heart of this dispute all these years?
Well, you're talking of Kashmir?
Yes.
All right. You know, Kashmir has been a point of dispute between India and Pakistan going back to 1947, when both countries became independent. And both have linked Kashmir with their national identity. India talking about Kashmir with reference to its secular identity, and Pakistan talking about Kashmir with reference to the principle that applied for the establishment of Pakistan in 1947, that is, the Muslim majority areas would become Pakistan. So in this way, both have tried to talk about Kashmir with reference to their identities, and they have fought wars over this territory.
Kashmir is a heavily Muslim province. That's why Pakistan, which calls itself an Islamic republic, wants possession of Kashmir, and that is also why India wants possession of Kashmir, because it wants to be seen as a secular state with a diverse population.
You are right. The predominant majority of population in Kashmir is Muslim, and both think that possession of Kashmir would complete and strengthen their identities in case of Pakistan, the Islamic identity, in case of India, the secular identity.
Okay, we're talking to Hassan Askari Rizvi, who is in Lahore, Pakistan, about the talks which are scheduled to come up on Monday between India and Pakistan. And Mr. Rizvi, what exactly is at issue? What's on the table in these talks?
Well, these are the first talks which would be taking place after they decided in January to resume talks. And what these talks are going to do are that they would set out the procedures for the negotiations that are likely to start very soon. So in a way, you could say that the talks which are starting the coming Monday would be talks for talks. They would settle the procedure. They would also discuss the agenda for the talk. And then we expect that from next month, the regular talks would start.
I suppose in one sense, from a public perspective, the value in these talks is that they're happening at all. If the two countries are talking to each other, they're a little less likely to be attacking each other in the middle of the night.
Yeah, that's right. I think for the last 2 years, situation was very tense in this region. And the fact that they have agreed to start talks and now they would be resuming talks early next week is something which is, you know, welcomed by everybody here as well as on the other side of the border.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep, sitting in for Neil Conan, and you can join our discussion about the proposed peace talks, or scheduled peace talks, I should say, between India and Pakistan by calling 800-989-8255. A lot of issues here that affect this part of the world, not least of which is the issue of nuclear proliferation. The nuclear arms race, as we mentioned, in India and Pakistan has led to admissions by Pakistan that some of its nuclear technology was sent around the world. Now, Mr. Rizvi, we're going to bring in a voice from India in a moment, but before we do, I would like to ask you about A.Q. Khan, a hero in Pakistan, known as the father of the Pakistani atomic bomb, but someone who has admitted selling secrets abroad. I'm wondering which is the bigger news story in Pakistan right now, the upcoming peace talks or the scandal over the nuclear secrets?
Well, I think for the last 2 weeks, the nuclear scientist issue has become story number one. Previously, India's story was number one. But both are important for two different reasons. India talks are important because this is being viewed as the beginning of the process which would improve India-Pakistan relations. And the other story about the nuclear scientist is also important because of its negative implications, because the official policy of government of Pakistan was not to encourage proliferation, but now the evidence is available that some of the scientists were doing the same thing quietly. So this has drawn a lot of attention and also criticism within Pakistan.
Is Dr. Khan still a hero in Pakistan?
Well, there is a lot of, you know, confusion here. He is, for the ordinary person, he is still a hero because he contributed to having a bomb for the country, which is considered to be integral to the security system. So for that respect, people do give credit and they would continue to give him credit. However, his admission that he was involved in these kind of illicit transfers have, raised questions about his genuineness.
Mr. Rizvi, stay with us for a moment, if you would. Glad you can join us this afternoon. And we want to bring in another voice here from a little bit more of an Indian perspective. Shumit Ganguly is professor of Indian society and political science at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. And he joins us now from member station WFIU in Bloomington. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Can you describe from your perspective very briefly what led up to these talks now between India and Pakistan?
I think there are a number of compelling factors that led up to these talks. For one thing, Prime Minister Bajpayee of India is very much concerned about his legacy. He would like to go down as India's Prime Minister who helped bring peace with Pakistan. He had made a number of overtures going back as early as February 1999, shortly after the Indian and Pakistani nuclear tests of May 1998. He had traveled to Lahore, the city where my friend Hassan Askari Rizvi is speaking from, and had publicly stated that he accepted the territorial integrity of Pakistan, which is a remarkable thing for an Indian prime minister, particularly a prime minister belonging to a fairly hawkish political party, to say. And then after that, he organized several ceasefires in the disputed state of Kashmir, which unfortunately were breached mostly by the insurgents. Subsequent to that, he also expressed a willingness to try and improve relations with Pakistan. And fortunately, in recent days, he was met with a degree of warmth by General Musharraf, who, in a public statement, finally agreed to dispense with Pakistan's commitment to holding a plebiscite to determine the wishes of the Kashmiris. This plebiscite goes back to the 1948 and 49 UN resolutions, something that India feels has been surpassed by other agreements between India and Pakistan, and that these are anachronistic resolutions. And when Musharraf publicly indicated his willingness to dispense or to set aside the UN resolutions, that made it possible for Bajpayee also push forward with the prospects of some discussions and negotiations.
Okay. Let me go back to Hassan Askari Rizvi very briefly. We've been just talking about what makes India more willing to talk at this time than in the past. Mr. Rizvi, you wrote a few years ago that the longer the settlement of the Kashmir problem is delayed, the more difficult it is to find a peaceful solution. I wonder if you think that it's been delayed too long, or if there is room for a peaceful solution from the Pakistani side here.
I think there is room for a peaceful solution. In the past, the problem was lack of flexibility on both sides. And in the case of Pakistan, Pakistan has indicated that it is willing to discuss all possible solutions of Kashmir problem, and it will not insist on the United Nations resolution. Now, this kind of flexibility has made it possible to go for the negotiations. And the second factor was that the Indian Prime Minister announced in April last year that he would be willing to go for negotiations. And since there was flexibility on both sides, the negotiations have become possible.
And they've come a long way since December of 2001, when these talks were broken off the last time, haven't they?
Oh, yes. I mean, 2001, the unfortunate incident at the Indian Parliament really destroyed all kind of relations that had been there between India and Pakistan.
Okay.
And for one year, there was a situation of confrontation between the two countries.
Got to stop you there. Hassan Askari Rizvi, thanks very much for speaking with us. Really appreciate it. Hassan Askari Rizvi is in Lahore, Pakistan. He's the author of Military State and Society in Pakistan. We're discussing the upcoming talks between India and Pakistan. You can join the discussion by calling 800-989-TALK. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. It's Talk of the Nation. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington. We're discussing the India-Pakistan talks, which start next Monday, and the region of Kashmir is at the heart of that conflict. If you have questions about what's at stake and why this is happening now, you can give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN at NPR.org, And if you have been or lived in Kashmir in the past, we'd like to hear from you as well. We're going to take a kind of travelogue of Kashmir starting in just a few minutes. Amazing mountainous region of the world. And you can call 800-989-8255. Staying with us now from WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana, is Professor Shumit Ganguly, who's the author of The Crisis in Kashmir, Portents of War, Hopes of Peace. And Mr. Ganguly, I want to ask about Pakistan's support for Islamic insurgents over the years. President Pervez Musharraf, just in the last few days, sent a message, spoke to the Kashmir legislature on the Pakistan side of the line of control, as it's called, and said that Islamic groups would receive no support from Pakistan. Is that assurance taken seriously, taken sincerely on the Indian side of the border now?
No, I suspect on the Indian side of the border, people are using Ronald Reagan's formulation, trust but verify. I don't think they're simply going to take General Musharraf at his word. I think what they're going to do is they're going to wait till about April or May, when the Himalayan snows start to melt and the passes through which the infiltration takes place open up. And if at that point one does not see infiltrators coming across and the Pakistani military not providing covering fire, I think people will take General Musharraf at his word and say, indeed, he has taken a very painful and difficult decision and has cut off support to the insurgents. But at the present time, I think people are going to be somewhat circumspect.
With the exception of a couple of recent incidents, it's been a relatively nonviolent winter in Kashmir. Is that fair to say?
Oh, I agree. It has been a relatively nonviolent winter. But on the other hand, infiltration and incidents as a consequence generally tend to taper off this time of year because of the extraordinary difficulty of trying to cross the mountainous region. We are talking about altitudes of anywhere from 12 to 16,000 feet with punishing winds and bitingly cold winters. So under these circumstances, it's extraordinarily difficult to penetrate into the valley and wreak havoc. So in any case, during this time of year, one does not see very many incidents.
You can join this discussion by calling 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. That is the number that Mark called from Kansas City, Missouri. He's been holding. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Happy to do it.
In the last segment, you and the gentleman from Pakistan were discussing the reasons for the conflict. And you kind of left it at both countries' desire to embrace the Kashmiri population, and that seems a little altruistic. What other roots exist? Like, there must be some economic reason that these two countries would fight this long for this land.
You're asking, is there oil or gold or something there? Is that what you're asking?
There must be something there besides the good of the people, or they wouldn't be nuking each other over it.
Shumit Ganguly, what's there?
Well, certainly there is no great mineral wealth. This is not strategic territory. So the question then arises, why are the two countries so much at odds? The answer is a somewhat complicated one. And let me see if I can provide a crisp version thereof. Pakistan was originally created as the homeland of the Muslims of South Asia. And Kashmir is India's only predominantly Muslim state. And Pakistan felt that since Kashmir abuts Pakistan and it's a predominantly Muslim state, it really should have gone to Pakistan when British rule ended in 1947. Unfortunately for Pakistan, the Maharaja, or the ruler of Kashmir, chose to join India despite the fact that the bulk of his subjects were Muslim, though he did have substantial Hindu and Buddhist subjects. And because of this, Pakistan precipitated a war in 1947-48 and then subsequently another one in 1965. Why did India want to hold on to Kashmir so desperately? Primarily because it wanted to show the world that in a predominantly Hindu country, where close to 80% of the population are Hindu, that a Muslim majority state could still thrive within a predominantly Hindu state, but a state that was committed to the principles of secularism system where your religion really did not matter, that regardless of your faith, you would be treated as an equal. In practice, this has not always worked out in India, and India today, while constitutionally a secular state, is not really a secular state because the Muslim minority frequently is the subject of discrimination within India.
Is it fair then to say that this conflict really is not about some economic desire, but about what you might call, depending on your point of view, religious or idealistic, ideological, even emotional bonds that people feel toward this region?
Not so much emotional bonds, it's more ideological in the case of Pakistan. And in the case of India, it's at least the constitutional defense of this idea of secularism. And quite apart from that, if one really were to pare this argument to the bone, one would essentially see that for Pakistan, this is also payback for what India did to Pakistan in 1971. We need to bear in mind that there was a civil war in Pakistan in 1971, and India intervened on behalf of the rebels and helped create the state of Bangladesh in the former East Pakistan. And so when India created a mess in Kashmir in 1989, because of a whole series of political malfeasances, the Pakistani military then stepped into the breach and decided to support the people who were disaffected with Indian rule. And today, India refuses to part with this territory because most states don't like to give up territory they consider to be their own.
Well, Mark, simple question, complicated answer. Does that answer it for you?
Yeah, I guess so. I just couldn't help but think that there must have been like an opium trade or a big pile of uranium or something there that made it worth fighting over. But
not that we are aware of.
Thanks for your call from Kansas City, Mark. Really appreciate it. Bye-bye. And let's go now to Holly, who's been holding in Peacham, Vermont. Holly, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, how are you?
Doing fine, thanks.
So I've been to both sides of the Kashmir territory, in Azad Kashmir and in Jammu Kashmir.
The Indian side and the Pakistani side, both.
Yeah. And as a Westerner traveler, I could say that it's definitely better on the Indian side. It's for a woman, they have women in public space on the Jammu Kashmir side. And on the Azad, the quote Azad Kashmir, which ironically means free, there are no women in the public space. It is a hostile male environment out there. If you're confined to the world outside of people's homes, so you know. In my personal opinion, I think it should stay with India.
Shumit Ganguly, what other differences would we find if we went to one side of that line of control, as it's called, and then the other?
Well, having been to both sides of the line of control, I concur with Holly's judgment, at least as far as the status of women go. And just to underscore the point that she has made, in recent months, actually not recent months, in the past year, some of the insurgent groups actually tried to throw acid on the faces of women on the Indian side who were going about with their faces uncovered. Which has always existed since even before 1947. Islam on the Indian side of Kashmir is markedly different from the kind of Islam that Pakistan has tried to promote over the years, particularly after 1947 in so-called Azad Kashmir. So that's one vitally important difference. The other thing is, in the Indian part of Kashmir, for all the sins of the Indian state, there is a genuinely elected representative regime that is in power in Srinagar. The same cannot be said on the other side of the border. Finally, in terms of economic development, I think any individual, and not even an economist, any intelligent individual looking at the two segments of Kashmir could see that the level of prosperity in the Indian side of Kashmir is considerably greater. This does not mean that India does not have certain things to answer for in terms of what it has done in the state of Jammu and Kashmir. But if one were to do a straightforward comparison along these three axes, the Indian side of Kashmir would look much better.
Pakistanis, some of them would argue that perhaps Islamic groups have been driven to extreme measures in Kashmir, but that they have been driven by oppression. That's the Pakistani version of events.
There's no question about it that the 1987 elections in Kashmir were completely compromised. And in large part, the Congress Party in New Delhi was responsible for this, which led a younger generation of Kashmiris who were much more conscious and aware of their political rights and privileges to rise up in revolt. But that was an indigenous revolt in 1989-1990. Subsequent to that, the very people who revolted then have been completely marginalized by all manner of people that Pakistan has systematically infiltrated into Kashmir. The people who they have infiltrated into Kashmir have no blood-soil relationship with the Kashmiris, do not have the best interests of the Kashmiris at heart, and have frequently killed large numbers of Muslims in the valley.
Holly, before we go away, can you just tell me briefly what were you doing on both sides of the border in Kashmir anyway? It's not a place that a lot of tourists go.
I worked for the relief agencies in Peshawar doing work with the Afghan refugees, and I just went there as a sightseer.
Beautiful place, isn't it?
Yeah, cool.
You went and did some hiking or something like that?
Yeah, did a little trekking, and I just like, you know, just...
Okay. Well, Holly, thanks very much for your call. Really appreciate it. And we're going to be talking a little bit more about the scenery, so to speak, in Kashmir, what kind of a place it is, what the people are like, what the battle lines look like, as a matter of fact. But we want to talk for another moment here with Shumit Ganguly before we do that. I'd like to know about the politics in Kashmir. Is it possible for us to know with any certainty what the people of that province really want, which country, India or Pakistan, they'd prefer to be aligned with?
This is an excellent question, and let me see if I can answer it briefly but adequately. First of all, we should not talk about the Kashmiri people. This is a formulation that the State Department uses, and I think this is a formulation that obfuscates much more than it clarifies. There are three major religious groups in the Indian-controlled portion of Kashmir, which constitutes about two-thirds of the original state. In this, of these three groups, the first group are the Muslims of the valley, which is where the insurgency is located. Immediately to the north of the valley is a region called Ladakh, which abuts China, which is predominantly Buddhist. And then in the south, one has the region called Jammu, which is predominantly Hindu. The Ladakhis, who are Buddhists, and the people of Jammu, who are Hindus predominantly, have no desire to be part of an independent Kashmir, nor do they desire to be part of Pakistan. The people within the valley, the vast majority of them, I suspect, if you could get an independent poll, would probably prefer to be independent. Some of them would like to join...
Independent from both sides.
Oh, absolutely. Independent from both sides. Their view, having traveled extensively in Kashmir as recently as not last summer, but the summer before, they would say a pox on both your houses. But well, these would be predominantly the Muslims of the valley who have suffered the most in the course of this insurgency from December 1989 onwards.
And can I just ask, after we briefly identify ourselves for our stations here, I'll mention that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we'll go on, Shumit Ganguly. Can I just ask very, very briefly here, these peace talks which are coming up on Monday, from your perspective, is there hope that, real progress could be made?
I do not expect a breakthrough, but I do expect the process to continue. It's in the interests of both parties to ensure that there is not a complete breakdown. General Musharraf and his regime has their backs against the wall. The recent revelations about Abdul Qadir Khan has completely belied General Musharraf's repeated claims that Pakistan has not engaged in any form of nuclear seepage. Furthermore, there have been two assassination attempts on his life. Pakistan's economy is in a state of doldrums. So Pakistan has a compelling interest in ensuring that these talks at least continue at least in a fitful fashion and that some progress is made. By the same token, for Mr. Bajpayee, this is basically his swan song. He's an aged man. If he does not succeed in achieving at least some movement on these talks, the chances of seeing a breakthrough within his lifetime will become exceedingly small. So both sides have a compelling interest in ensuring that the talks do not collapse.
Shumit Ganguly, thanks very much for taking the time. I really appreciate your help.
My pleasure entirely.